Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Larkin, Judge Siegel, Judge Bjorkman, Honorable Michelle A. Larkin presiding.
Thank you. Please be seated.
Welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. It's 28th day of February, 2024. We have only two cases on our oral calendar this morning. The first is State of Minnesota versus Chavez Aguilar. We're ready for oral arguments. Each attorney should state his or her name immediately before presenting each leg of the argument. It's my understanding that we have a student attorney arguing for the state this morning. So do you have any questions about procedure before we get started?
No, Your Honor.
All right, then. We will begin with arguments from defense counsel.
Good morning, and may it please the court and opposing counsel. My name is David Robbins. I'm the attorney for appellant Richard Chavez Aguilar. Both issues before the court today ask this court to analyze the impact of recent developments within the state on this court's search and seizure jurisprudence. The first issue asks this court how to weigh an officer's failure to recall certain critical events at a suppression hearing when the officer was required by his department's policy to activate his now commonplace body-worn camera. The second issue asks this court to apply the recent Supreme Court precedent of State v. Torgerson and hold that the facts in this case fall far short of establishing the probable cause standard needed to justify a vehicle search in light of the change to Minnesota's marijuana laws as recognized by Torgerson. Regarding the first issue, appellant argues the state failed to demonstrate that it initiated its interaction with appellant in accordance with the Constitution, as the officer failed to recall what events precipitated appellant lowering his vehicle's window, and as previously stated, officer failed to activate his body-worn camera to record the interaction.
So on the first point, the sort of factual, I don't remember, let's assume the officer did, I mean, it was December, so presumably the window was rolled up when the officer approached. Let's assume the officer either asked, gave a verbal direction to roll down the window, or tapped on the glass with the flashlight. What difference does that make? Why would that convert this situation into a seizure?
I wouldn't necessarily say, Your Honor, that a tap would elevate this to the initiation of a stop. But the question, I think the key question before the court is, what precipitated appellant to lower his window? Did he do so in response to a show of force? And unfortunately, the record is silent entirely on what precipitated appellant lowering his
window. So then, in the absence of a record, wouldn't it just be sheer speculation to say there was a show of force as opposed to a simple verbal direction, or, you know, as in Lacey, the tapping of the windshield with the flashlight? Why would we assume there was something more than that?
I'm not asking this court to assume. My argument is more narrow than that. Here, there should have been a record. Bloomington Police Department policy required that there be a record. It's the state's, so the state had a duty to collect this evidence. They imposed a duty in its Bloomington Police Department policy to collect this evidence, and the failure to collect the evidence is the state's fault, not appellant's fault.
So why isn't the sort of what the district court concluded, that the rolling of the window happened because of the officer, not because your client rolled the window down as the officer was approaching? So why not approaching the issue from that lens? Why doesn't that take care of the lack of evidence problem? I mean, attributing to the officer initiated the rolling down of the window. So let's just assume that, which is what the district court did. Doesn't that take care of the failure to collect that, either to recall or the failure to collect that evidence by virtue of the body-worn camera?
No, Your Honor, I don't think it does, because under State v. Edstrom, my argument would be that the state has the burden of proving that it initiated the stop consistent with the Constitution. And the state didn't satisfy this burden because the state didn't adduce evidence at the suppression hearing that clearly demonstrated to a preponderance of the evidence standard that they initiated the stop in accordance with the Constitution. There is simply no evidence.
In the seizure.
Sorry, the seizure, yes, yes.
Of that a seizure occurred, because this
yes.
wasn't a case, you agree this wasn't a case where they initiated any stop. The car was already
correct,
stopped.
Correct, correct. Yes, correct.
But doesn't the judge, as the finder of fact, though, have, I mean, can infer, you know, from the officer's testimony that it wasn't a seizure? I mean, that seems to be what the district court judge, in fact, did.
The issue is there is no evidence, one way or other, about what caused appellant to lower his window. So inferring that there was no commanding show of force that a reasonable person would feel they couldn't disregard. So determining that, inferring that the officer didn't do a show of force, to me is unsupported by the record because there is no evidence in the record to suggest what the officer did. Again, the officer says, I don't recall. It's possible, it's equally possible that the officer engaged in a show of force as it is that appellant voluntarily lowered his window on these facts. And again, the state was required by Bloomington Police Department policy to present evidence of the body-worn camera. They should have recorded it. That's not appellant's issue that he failed to record. That's the state's issue here. So
do you have any case law that would support your argument that the failure to make a recording through the body-worn camera that was required by the police department, and clearly the officer here forgot to or did not engage, that creates a constitutional issue that you are
so
urging us to find?
I'm not necessarily arguing that this is a due process issue in and of itself. As this court is aware, in Scales, the Minnesota Supreme Court didn't even find necessarily a constitutional right, a due process right to having your interrogation recorded. So I'm not clearly arguing that there's a due process right at issue. What I am arguing, however, is that under State v. Edstrom, if the state has the burden of proving that at a suppression hearing it conducted its search in accordance with the Constitution, the state hasn't met that burden because it didn't introduce evidence at the suppression hearing to demonstrate that fact. And again, the issue, so I think, you know, the Supreme Court in Robinson and then Pilcher and then Scales has admonished the state to make sure that you're using the technological means at your disposal. I think this would be a good opportunity for this court to maybe clarify the importance of activating body-worn cameras, especially when officers, number one, they have them on their uniform, and number two, there's a police department policy in place stating that you have to activate it. And this is an officer.
But in Edstrom, I think the Supreme Court also said, you know, the burden is on the person challenging, right?
Right.
So weren't you obligated to come forward with some sort of evidence that would support a district court determination that, in fact, there was a show of force?
Yeah, and if this court analyzes the issue under Edstrom as my client's burden to show that there was a constitutional right implicated, this becomes a much more challenging case for my client. But I still think, nevertheless, the second issue is dispositive. And if this court is okay, I'd like to turn to the second issue, which is the application of Minnesota Supreme Court precedent State v. Torgerson.
One question before you do.
Yes, Your Honor.
It's my recollection, and I could be wrong, with regard to constitutional challenges to the admissibility of evidence in a criminal case, the burden the defense has is to present evidence showing that a constitutional right is at stake, which is generally, I have a reasonable expectation of privacy, I'm in a protected area, and we agree that the car is protected. Are you conceding that the defense burden may go beyond that? I was of the impression that the defense has to establish the expectation to privacy, that there's essentially standing to challenge the action, and then the state has the ultimate burden of proving then that evidence was constitutionally obtained.
Your Honor, you're correct in stating the holding of Edstrom. I think the issue that appellant faces, or at least as I understand the state's argument is saying there's no privacy right implicated if this is just an officer approaching an individual on the street, whether the individual wouldn't have a reasonable belief that they could, or had a reasonable belief that they could disregard the officer's command. So again, the question is, was this a interaction between law enforcement and a civilian that implicated the Constitution in the first instance?
How do we get to a seizure from rolling down the window if you're seated in a stopped vehicle? The theory is, well, now I can't leave because the officer has directed me to roll down the window?
Yeah, okay. Certainly if an officer said, roll down the window right now, I mean, I think a reasonable person would believe that they're not free to proceed on their own at that point.
And here we know nothing about the circumstances having to do with why the window was rolled down.
Correct.
So
that's
in
correct.
Theory, there are circumstances that could show a seizure. Others might not, but the record isn't clear.
That's correct. Yep.
Understood. Thank you.
And with regard to State v. Torgerson, so as this court's well aware, State v. Torgerson, September 2023, Minnesota Supreme Court opinion cited throughout the briefs. State v. Torgerson held that in light of certain changes to the state's marijuana laws, namely the adoption of medical marijuana, the legalization of a marijuana-like substance, hemp, and then the decriminalization of a small amount of marijuana, including a small amount of marijuana and held in a car, those three legal changes changed the nature of marijuana to make it more akin to alcohol. It used to be that marijuana was essentially always contraband in the state. There wasn't medical marijuana that was legal. Hemp wasn't legal. Maybe a small amount of marijuana was legal, but alcohol and marijuana are now a lot more similar than they used to be. And that's what Torgerson, go ahead, you're on.
On Torgerson, can you remind me, what was the date of offense in Torgerson, the date of the...
The date of offense, I want to say, that's in our brief and a footnote. I want to say it was 4 months prior to the arrest of Chavez Aguilar in this case. So they were both in, Chavez Aguilar, the stop was in December.
What was the effective date of the statute the Supreme Court relied on in Torgerson?
So there were two statutes, the medical marijuana statute, off the top of my head, I'm trying to recall, I believe that was in the mid-2010s, and then the U.S. Farm Bill, I want to say was in 2018, I think that was federal legislation, there was corresponding state legislation that legalized
hemp. Okay, so it's clear that the laws that the Supreme Court was referring to went into effect for the date of the seizure in Torgerson.
Correct, yeah, so Thiel, which is the latest case cited by the state, that was a 2011 arrest, and then now we have 2021 arrests, yep. So because of the fact that the legal status of marijuana has changed significantly, the Supreme Court essentially held that we ought to analyze the odor of marijuana similar to the odor of alcohol. And here, there's...
That's a good point. But if we were dealing with alcohol in this case and the officer smelled odor of an alcoholic beverage and saw someone drinking a beverage in a car, that's illegal.
That is illegal. And
now someone using marijuana in a car is illegal. So I'm having a hard, I agree with the analogy to alcohol use because I do think it's much more similar now. But I don't understand how you get to make that pitch and then say the circumstances here didn't give rise to probable cause if there was an odor of marijuana, sight of a smoking device.
Yep. So the officers here saw the marijuana smoking device. Appellant admitted that he possessed marijuana, and they smelled marijuana.
Why isn't that enough for probable cause for a search, even under Torgerson, which mentioned the absence of marijuana paraphernalia mm-hmm. or any indication of use that could be illegal?
So the key issue here is that this is not a challenge of a field sobriety test. Clearly, law enforcement had the probable cause to execute a field sobriety test and, and investigate a suspicion of a possible operation while intoxicated. The issue is they searched the vehicle. So in order to search the vehicle under Torgerson, law enforcement must have a belief that there's a fair probability that contraband or criminal activity or evidence of criminal activity will be found in the vehicle. Here we have three redundant facts. We know that officers smell marijuana. We know that officers see a marijuana smoking device. And further, we know that appellant admits that he has marijuana.
We know it's not hemp, right?
Potentially, but as I say in my brief.
He admitted it was marijuana.
Yeah, that's, and you know.
And 1.4 grams isn't a lot of marijuana, is it?
1.4 grams is not very much marijuana, but there's nothing in the record to suggest that officers had any reason to believe that there was more than 1.4 ounces of, or sorry, grams of marijuana in the vehicle. And even though he admitted, yes, I have marijuana in the vehicle, I think giving appellant, or stating that appellant understood the difference between hemp and marijuana is giving him maybe a little bit too much credit.
But we're talking probable cause here. We're not talking sufficiency of the evidence to convict. And I share Judge Larkin's, I guess, query as to why, you know, the additional factors here, the observation of him smoking marijuana and with having a smoking device in his hands, and the admission that in fact there was marijuana in the vehicle. Why that isn't enough to say we got plus Torgerson, and that's enough for probable cause.
I see my time is up, and I'm happy to answer.
Please do.
The reason why is because I don't see in those facts any indication that would push this past Torgerson to say, oh, he appeared nervous, he was sweating, there's something amiss here, there's some sort of illegal activity afoot. He wasn't evasive, he wasn't sweating, he was cooperative.
Okay. But do you agree there was probable cause to believe he was using marijuana in the motor vehicle?
Absolutely. I do believe
and
that there was
probable. Your position is that would not give rise to search for marijuana?
In the vehicle, correct.
So it was legal to sit and use marijuana in the vehicle?
It was illegal for him to use marijuana while operating, and law enforcement had probable cause to do a field sobriety test, but not to search the vehicle.
It was illegal for him to use it while operating. And doesn't operating include physical control of a vehicle?
So he had physical control of the vehicle, but the issue is what is the probable cause to believe from those facts that.
But I'm saying if we assume there was probable cause to believe he was using marijuana in that motor vehicle.
Mm-hmm.
Why doesn't that give, I mean, if same facts with alcohol, it's like the case law is clear. If you see somebody drinking a can of beer in a car, you get to search the car for other evidence of contraband, which is the alcohol. I guess what I'm asking you is, was it legal for him to be smoking marijuana in a car?
No. It was not legal.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I just have one question, please. Which it's fine if you want to address this and
please do.
Rebuttal, but in Torgerson, the Supreme Court discusses St. Paul v. Moody, which granted is a very short opinion. But one of the facts that the Supreme Court, you know, in distinguishing it, says, well, there was a strong odor of paint fumes. So spray paint is not an illegal substance. But so if you could discuss where are we between Torgerson and Moody, which dealt with a, you know, as the Supreme Court outlines it, you know, legal activity, as far as I know, even if you're sniffing fumes from it. I don't know that activity, as long as you're over the age of 18, is illegal.
There were other factors in Moody that gave law enforcement probable cause to believe that illegal activity was afoot, including, I believe, the car was illegally parked.
But that would be a traffic ticket. I mean, that wouldn't be. I mean, and you're distinguishing, like, the purpose of the, you know, what can you search for then? I think being illegally parked would give a. Go ahead, finish.
Your Honor, the facts of Moody aren't fresh in my mind, but I just believe that there were other facts in that case that gave officers probable cause. It wasn't a search premise solely on the odor of paint.
Okay. Thank you, Your Honor.
Good morning, and may it please the court, counsel. My name is Emily Toms, appearing this morning on behalf of Respondent State of Minnesota under the supervision of Senior Assistant Hennepin County Attorney Adam Petras. Fourth Amendment analysis is governed by the totality of the circumstances. Under the totality, no singular fact controls, and it is all of the facts presented taken together that determine whether the Fourth Amendment has been violated. Based on the district court's factual findings, the totality of the circumstances here show that appellant was not seized when Officer Markham first approached his vehicle and that the eventual search of appellant's car was supported by probable cause. I'm happy to answer this court's questions if there are any.
Yes, on the first issue. So we'd understand that the undisputed facts are defendant or appellant was seated in a motor vehicle running dark area late at night, officer was concerned, approached, and somehow the window went down, but the record doesn't tell us whether the officer ordered him, appellant, to roll it down, knocked on the window, or appellant rolled it down on its own, his own.
The Judge Moreno did find that Officer Markham directed, was the word that Judge Moreno used, directed appellant to roll down the window. Judge Moreno also found, though, that there was no testimony to suggest that that direction was done in a tone or a manner requiring compliance, as we see in the fourth Mendenhall-Royer factor.
Okay, but the question I have is this. If ultimately what we're looking at is whether the interaction between the police officer and the citizen was one that would not reasonably be expected between private citizens, and I imagine if I were seated in my car at night alone and someone walked up and said, roll down your window, I would in no way, shape, roll down my window, I would drive away. So I'm questioning whether that's a usual interaction between citizens. And if it's not, we have to then explain why it is not a seizure under the test I began with.
Sure. So the, going off of the reaction that Your Honor stated, the seizure occurs if a reasonable person believes that they are not free to leave. So under that very reasonable reaction to an approach at night, the indication of somebody asking to roll down the window doesn't indicate I have to stay. And that is what EDJ is talking about when we're referring to a seizure.
But the other part of that test asks, is the way the officer interacted with the person beyond what we would expect from normal citizens? And so I think there's case law that says if a citizen is standing on the street corner and the officer says, hey, you, come here, the Supreme Court, or I guess it was this court, said that's not normal action between citizens. That's a seizure. So are you saying that it would be normal for a citizen to walk up to a parked car and order the driver to roll down their window?
I believe that it is common in regular interactions to request things of a different person. And I will admit.
Okay, but there's requesting things as, oh, we're in Target, the lanes are small, excuse me, could you move your cart, I need to pass. That seems quite different than going up to a stranger at night who's parked in their car and asking them to roll down the window.
Sure. And Your Honor, in this, I would point to Lacey, where under very similar circumstances, an officer approached, had a flashlight, area was illuminated with a spotlight. The officer indicated using the flashlight a signal for the driver to roll down the window, and this court found that did not constitute a seizure. That did not extend past the bounds of what a regular interaction would entail.
Thank you.
But in Lacey, we had a record, right? I mean, in Lacey, there was a record of the officer, I think, using a flashlight to tap on the window. Here, what I think I'm hearing from appellant's argument is that we should assume the worst here, because this officer was under an obligation per police policy to have that body-worn camera operated whenever there was interaction with a civilian, and that officer failed to do so. So we should infer the worst. We should infer that a seizure in fact occurred, that there was a show of force beyond simply tapping the window with a flashlight. How do you respond to that argument?
I would like to respond in two parts. First, relating to Lacey, even by the time that Lacey reached this court, there was some ambiguity as to what the actual motion was. The language indicates a signal, but there was dispute amongst the parties at that time about what exactly that signal entailed.
Right, but Lacey testified, I'm looking at the case right now, that the officer in fact tapped on the window. So that was part of the record.
Sure. Relating to appellant's argument about assuming the worst, I'd like to distinguish for this court constitutional violations versus policy violations, in that, of course, we want police officers to comply with their department policy. That is not in question. However, there is a clear distinction between failing to comply with policy and engaging in conduct that rises to a constitutional violation. And in the recording instance, that has been only established as when the state loses, destroys, or fails to preserve. And failing to affirmatively gather evidence does not fall into those categories. The remedy of construing facts that are arguably absent or potentially ambiguous in favor of defense due to a policy violation is not based in case law. The state was unable to find, and I don't believe that appellant cites any case law supporting that remedy for the state's failure to collect that evidence. And so the wrapping up on this answer here, the Croce establishes a specific narrow constitutional duty for the state to preserve the evidence that it obtains through investigation, but does not establish a duty to affirmatively gather that evidence. And so any proposed remedy coming from that doesn't have a basis either.
So you would assert that that what the district court did, and that is assume that the appellant rolled the window down because asked to do so, directed to do so, that was the appropriate remedy.
Yes.
For the lack of evidence.
Correct. And I would also like to note that at the district court, this particular factual issue was not raised. The factual issue before the district court was whether the appellant entirely of his own volition rolled down the window or did so in response to some sort of direction or instruction by the police officer. And the testimony highlighted in, I believe, both briefs relating to this tone or mannerism, it was a single question on cross-examination that received no follow-up and was not briefed.
Why does that matter?
Yes.
I mean, it's still the same legal issue, whether was there a seizure?
Correct. And I believe I point to that as an explanation for the lack of record here, is that appellant's primary contention seems to be that because the state failed to create a record on this, that then the ambiguity should be construed in favor of the appellant. However, the reason for failing to develop a record on that was because the issue wasn't raised. The state did not know. The district court did not know that.
The appellant waived that argument then or forfeited it somehow or another? Because I didn't see that in your brief either.
That's correct. And I would not go as far as to say that that's a waiver. But in terms of, as I mentioned, an explanation for the lack of record there, I believe that that's a relevant point. And where the factual dispute was presented to the district court, that was resolved. The district court stated that appellant rolled down the window in response to the direction rather than entirely on his own. Moving to the second issue, I'd like to just respond briefly to the argument in appellant's reply brief on pages 8 through 10 relating to Thiel and Hansen. An appellant states that through Torgerson, those two cases are effectively overruled due to the Supreme Court's new analysis on marijuana. But I would like to note that Torgerson addressed a very narrow issue relating to the odor of marijuana alone. And Thiel and Hansen, I will note that Thiel, I believe, did involve some, I think primarily it was an odor-based opinion. So that portion of Thiel would agree that is likely superseded by Torgerson. However, for the reasons that the state has cited those cases, that in Thiel, the presence of a marijuana pipe, and for Hansen, the presence of a marijuana cigarette, leading to a fair probability that there would be more marijuana in the vehicle, those particular aspects of those cases have not been overruled by Torgerson. I believe that would drastically expand the scope of what the Supreme Court was doing in Torgerson to impact case law unrelated or not based in marijuana odor.
In trying to distinguish Torgerson, it seems like the only other fact is the presence of a pipe. So what else is there? I mean, why should we say, oh, this falls, you know, on the this side of the law as opposed to the Torgerson side?
In that, I would point to the cumulative value of the three primary facts that are highlighted in the state's brief. So there's the odor, which was confirmed by seeing the smoking device in appellant's hand as he was sitting in the driver's seat, and then the admission that there was marijuana in the car. At the time of this incident, more than 1.4 grams of marijuana in a motor vehicle was a misdemeanor, which is a very small amount. So the cumulative value of those three facts create a fair probability not only that marijuana was being smoked in the vehicle at the time or very soon before the officer approached, but also adding in the admission creates a fair probability that there was more marijuana in the vehicle than the officer could see. And in Torgerson, there was no, the appellant and the other individuals in the vehicle, I believe just his partner, repeatedly denied having marijuana in the vehicle, smoking marijuana with any recency to the stop. If there are no further questions from this court.
I don't see any.
Thank you
for your argument. Rebuttal?
Thank you, Your Honor. There was a few questions about the Burback standard and whether or not if an open container would justify a vehicle search, why wouldn't the presence of a marijuana pipe in this case similarly justify a vehicle search? As this court knows, the possession of an open container in a vehicle is in and of itself a crime, and as I believe it's State versus Shenzing, this court or the Supreme Court held that if officers have fair probability to believe that a vehicle contains an open container, they have the ability to search the vehicle. I'm not aware of any precedent that says that analysis applies to the site of a marijuana smoking device. While it is true that it is illegal to smoke marijuana behind the wheel of a car when you're in possession of a car, again, that doesn't necessarily justify a search of the entire vehicle, absent some evidence to suggest that the vehicle contains a criminal amount of marijuana. So,
which again is 1.4 grams.
Which is 1.4 grams.
Which is a small amount.
It is a small amount, but the record here is devoid of any.
But Separate, in Torgerson, they specifically said, we don't have any evidence of illegal use, and we don't have any evidence of paraphernalia that would enable use. And you're conceding that use of marijuana in the car by your client was illegal.
Mm-hmm.
So I just don't see why there isn't probable cause to search for additional marijuana, because we have an illegal use of marijuana, which doesn't that render any marijuana in the car illegal?
No, I don't think it does, Your Honor. So take, for example, a traditional drunk driving stop. Officers smell the odor of alcohol. They understand that there might be some sort of illegal use of alcohol, but that wouldn't give them justification to search the entire vehicle. And
unless they saw an open can in the driver's hand.
Which in and of itself is a crime. But the paraphernalia in this case isn't in and of itself a crime. It's the use while driving a vehicle, which would say that the officers have the ability to seize appellant but not search his vehicle. So that's the distinction I'm trying to draw. The question here is, did the state have fair probability to believe that his vehicle contained evidence of a crime or of a contraband? And again, yes, 1.4 grams, exceedingly small, but the officers never say on the record, in our experience, if someone has a marijuana smoking device, there's likely to be more than 1.4 grams of marijuana in the vehicle. There's just nothing in the record. So the court might correctly say, yeah, I mean, if the state had developed the record more, maybe there would be fair probability, but we're stuck with this record. And this record, the officer simply says, I smelt it, I saw the smoking device, and then he admitted, and then I searched the vehicle. Well, where did the officer say, based on my experience and training, I expected there to be a criminal amount of marijuana in the vehicle? It's just not in the record, which is, I think, the biggest issue for this court. There's just no allegation, and again, with Moody, you've got other factors that indicate that there's some sort of some crime afoot, right? In this case, it's not suspicious the vehicle's parked where it is. He's not evasive. He admits that he's got marijuana, which in theory is less evasive than Torgerson. No, there's no marijuana in the vehicle, but I smell marijuana. That's the definition of evasiveness. In this case, yes, there is marijuana in the vehicle. That's not evasive. He admits he's not nervous. He's not sweating. He's fully cooperative. So to say that there's any other evidence besides those three factors, that there's potential contraband or criminal activity within that vehicle to justify a vehicle search, I think that the record is just simply absent of such evidence. If there's no further questions, Your Honor, I just simply request that this court reverse the decision of the trial court and remand with instructions to suppress the evidence. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you to both of the parties for your briefing and your arguments. Very helpful. The matter is under advisement. You'll have our decision within 9 days.